Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi everyone and welcome to Pixels, a podcast for the discerning gamer. Everyone, welcome back to Pixels. This is a show where we cover the news from the video games industry. I'm Patrick Beja, and today I'm going to be doing another solo show. The schedule is still a little bit complicated with the baby, so hopefully this is going to be the last one of those, and we can get back to our regularly scheduled programming, starting with the next episode. But yeah, another one of those. I hope you still enjoy them, but we're going to be doing a quick one, and we start with great news for Capcom. They've sold over 7.5 million copies of Monster Hunter World. We talked about the game last episode, and we mentioned that it was getting rave reviews from pretty much everyone and great reactions from players as well. So it's not, I mean, you might think, well, in that case, it's normal that they sell that much, but this is likely going to be the highest selling game in Capcom's history ever, which obviously is very significant. The Monster Hunter formula was bound to be discovered by the West. Obviously, it sold incredibly well in Japan as well. It would be interesting to know how much was sold in the West and how much in Japan. Likely at least a couple of millions in Japan. It's a very big game there. So pretty big win for Capcom. This is bigger than their previously biggest selling game, which was Resident Evil and Resident Evil 5. But the Resident Evil 5 got other additional editions that brought it over 10 million. So, yeah, I'm actually more surprised that it's selling more than the Street Fighter series, which I guess shouldn't surprise me because the heyday of the Street Fighter series was at a time where video games weren't as wide-reaching as they are today. But there you go. The interesting thing there is that Monster Hunter doesn't have any additional monetization means because they've said that every piece of content that would be brought afterwards would be brought for free, including monsters and stuff like that. Which I'm sure some people will applaud, but the other side of that coin is that it's not a lot of content, and it seems that a lot of players already kind of the players that went through the game the quickest spent a lot of time in it, but now they don't have a lot of stuff to do anymore. So yeah, take out of that what you will. Still, huge success for Capcom, and by all accounts, an incredible game. I'm still, I don't want to say lukewarm. I think I like it fine, but I don't know that I will get beyond that I like it fine stage. Maybe because I don't have any more time to play the game, but it's, yeah. Anyway, I've said what I thought already, so it's cool. It's all right, and it's a piece of video game history now, so that alone is a reason to get it and give it a try. Another big success in the sales department is Horizon Zero Dawn. We all knew that the first party game for the PlayStation 4 was super, super successful, obviously one of the best games of last year. And it sold 7.6 million units worldwide a year after release. The interesting thing there is that obviously It is a very similar number to the one I just mentioned for Monster Hunter World, but it's on one platform only. It's a PlayStation 4 exclusive, and it's looking like it's the highest selling game in the first party category for PlayStation ever. It's surpassed games by Naughty Dog. Weird pronunciation there. So yeah, it's selling better than things like Uncharted and The Last of Us. So pretty, I mean, everyone knew that this was a huge success, but I don't think anyone would have guessed that it would become the best-selling first-party game on the PlayStation platform in its history. So expect to see Horizon Zero Dawn games for the next 15 years at least, I suppose. I will be very excited to see what they do with Aloy and that world in the future. There's a lot of stuff to be explored still. Mechanically, it's going to be interesting to see how they bring you back to a more manageable, maybe they give you, you still have all of your abilities and you add more onto them. But anyway, that's very, I'm just wondering how they're going to mechanically create a sequel that still makes you feel like you master additional stuff, but doesn't make you feel like you've lost what you've done in the past. So maybe there's no choice and they will have to go that route. But if you're still playing Aloy, it would be weird to have her become less powerful all of a sudden. But yeah, that's video games, I guess. Metal Gear Survive has been released, and obviously people know that this is one of the first Metal Gear titles without Hideo Kojima at the helm. There have been others, but I mean, this is a significant one because he was unceremoniously fired, 2 years ago from Konami, and Konami has basically garnered the scorn of the entire gaming community. So the release of this game, which has very little in common with the canonical Metal Gear series, is, well, so first of all, the game isn't great. Apparently it's not too bad. You know, it's one of those, all right, whatever kind of game, like you play it and you never think about it again after that. So it's not going to turn any heads by any means. The really interesting thing, however, is when there's a sort of an Easter egg in the game, when you select your name, you have a list of those, you know, the famous Metal Gear names where you have an animal and an adjective. So a list of those names. And in those is a hidden message, seemingly from the team, maybe from one developer or one person in the team, where the first letter of some of the name, the second... So the first letter of the last name of some of those, when you put them together, they create the message KJP Forever. So Kojima Productions Forever. And the last two names on that list are Bastard Yoda and Cunning Yuji Yoda, Y-O-T-A. And those are the names of the two of the leads of the game from, you know, Konami. So I don't know how that wasn't noticed, especially the last two. But yeah, it seems that the rumors about Konami being a notoriously difficult company to work at, and some of the employees being less than happy with their working conditions, we've heard horror stories about those, with constantly changing emails and, I mean, pretty terrible stuff. That found an echo in that little Easter egg. So, yeah, it's the kind of game no one would have really noted if it wasn't called Metal Gear, and I don't think anyone is going to remember it. The interesting thing is going to be, what does Konami do with the franchise in the future? It's I can't imagine we're not going to see a Metal Gear 6 at some point, and we'll see how that goes. But yeah, so Metal Gear Survive, as expected, it's not turning heads anywhere. Detroit Become Human is going to be available on PlayStation 4, of course, on May 25th. So we have a release date for that. Assassin's Creed Origins Discovery Tour has been released. It was released a couple of weeks ago. It's a free upgrade for people who have the game, and it's available for $20 on PC as a standalone. It's not available on a standalone on the other platforms. For those who don't remember what that mode is, basically it is a way to explore the map of Assassin's Creed Origin and the history and culture of ancient Egypt. And I was afraid when they announced it that it would be just a quick job where they would just get loads and loads of text somewhere in the game and you would roam around and click on stuff and read the text. Well, I'm happy to report that this is not what it's like. It's actually pretty well done. You play as basically any character. It doesn't really matter. You roam around the map, and what you find there are tours. You can teleport to them, of course, but they're icons in the world where you have a theme for the tour, and when you click on them, you start the tour, and it takes you through a path that's superimposed on the game world, like a GPS type UI. And you have different steps in that tour, and you have a narrator that tells you about the topic. So, for example, let's say you have a tour about the pyramids, or education in Alexandria, or any one of those. You will have like from 3 to 15 different steps, and every step the narrator, the game pauses kind of and gives you a vista, and the narrator tells you about this specific place or topic, and you can have you can look at a piece of archaeological data, be it an image or a photo or something like this, and you can look around, and then you walk some more to the next step, and it tells you a little bit more, and etc. until you complete the tour. And it feels quite compelling. You can, of course, roam freely in the map between the different tours. So you can also look at how things are going in the game world without any risk of encountering having an encounter that would, start a fight or anything like that. And it's honestly very well done. And I would be... So what I would love, actually, is for them to retrofit this kind of thing in every Assassin's Creed game, which obviously is never going to happen. I really hope they keep doing this for the future. I think it's a very valuable tool. And it tells you also when they made choices that were artistic choices for the game, and what the historical accuracy was in that context and stuff like that. So overall, I really like it. I think it's valuable. It's a great... I had an interesting discussion with my French co-host on the French version of the show, and we had a discussion about how historically accurate things need to be. And I think this is a great compromise, because you get the flavor of history in the game, even though it's obviously not very accurate. And you then, if you're interested in that, you can dig a little bit further with that discovery tour, and maybe then go into, if you're really passionate about it, go into reading books and actually scholarly works on the topic. And I think there's the question of how well will it work with as a teaching aid. And some people are saying, well, the accuracy might be a problem. And I really don't think so. I think it's, again, a great way of making it palatable and interesting to people who might not have realized that they were interested to begin with. So imagine being in a class and maybe a portion of your class is spent doing this, and then you are a little bit interested, and the professor or the teacher tells you a little bit more about the actual way that things were going in that portion of Egyptian history, or any setting that these games take place in. So I think they have a good start at a teaching aid with that first version. And it's a really interesting one. I'd be curious to hear if some teachers end up using it as a tool to get people a little bit interested. Nintendo rumors, or at least one rumor. It's been, obviously, Nintendo always releases new versions of their hardware, especially the handheld hardware. They have new versions pretty soon after release sometimes. There's been rumors of a new version of the Switch, or I shouldn't say rumors, speculation is more appropriate. Everyone thought that this would be happening, and to be fair, it will very likely happen at some point in the future. But the rumor now is that Nintendo is holding off on a second version of the hardware that they were developing. It doesn't mean, you know, it was going to be released this year, but they're holding off on making plans to release it even maybe the year after that. And they're focusing on peripherals and things like that to get more sales. The really interesting thing here is that it seems pretty obvious, you know, the Switch is still selling incredibly well, and there's no reason to put out a different version of the hardware, because the goal there is usually to re-dynamize, that's a French word, to revitalize the sales. And you can sell that piece of hardware to people who already have the previous one and who want the more modern, better, smaller one. So that's one way to go. Obviously, you can make a portable-only version or a TV-only version, stuff like that. That would also work. I guess before they did that, they would need to have saves that would be saved to the cloud so that you can switch between the different versions of the console you have. But that's another discussion, and I don't know that Nintendo is ever going to manage to do that. But yeah, so it doesn't make sense for them to release a new version of the hardware this early into a hugely successful console cycle. So I have no doubt we will see that happen at some point, but it's working out so well for them that they don't need the marketing boost from that, and they're still having trouble, you know, producing enough of this version of the machine to satisfy the demand. So really no reason. So it's not a surprise per se. I know a lot of people are hearing this and going like, well, duh. And yes, I understand it's not very surprising, but in a way, it's kind of a consequence of the surprise of the success of the Switch, which, as people might remember, a year ago, because the Switch is basically 1 year old, what an anniversary, what a console, it wasn't a given. So I am certain they had plans for a new hardware, and they are pushing them. So it's not as well duh as you might think. So there you go. And since we're talking about the Switch, I do want to mention the game I've been playing on the Switch, Celeste, which I did talk about last episode, and I want to talk about again because I finished it. And I would like to reiterate how incredible that game is. I think it is a really wonderful experience, and I can't remember if I said this quite like that in the previous episode, but it blends the storytelling and the gaming experience in a way that makes the player feel what the character feels through the gameplay. And that is an achievement that is only possible with the video game medium. So not only that, but the game is also really fun and sometimes frustrating, but ultimately rewarding. And the story unfolds in a way that is very unique and very enchanting. And all of this works together so well. I love that game very, very much. It's on my Game of the Year list, and I would encourage it. It's only $20. It's great on the Switch. It's available on all platforms. I would really recommend people give it a try. It's the kind of game that I never thought I would enjoy, and Celeste makes me enjoy it. Very quickly, for people who might not have heard me talk about it on basically every show, it's a precision platformer die and retry game where you will die many, many times until you manage to get the mechanical skills that allow you to go through the different little screens and little levels. But the way it's structured makes you enables you to do things by the end of the game that you would have looked at, 10, 15 hours of gameplay before and would have thought, this is just not for me. I'm not even going to try. But it manages to do it. It's unforgiving, but welcoming. It's wholesome. It's beautiful. And it's hard. It's, I can't say enough good things about Celeste. I would really recommend you give it a try. At least, check out someone's, give it a try yourself. Like, find a friend who has it and say, give me a save. I'm going to give it a half an hour if you don't want to spend the $20. But I doubt that many people would regret it if they actually do spend the $20. So this is one of those games that I think, I always like to recommend games with two different styles of recommendations. Either a game is great for its genre and fans of the genre have to play it because it's so great in that thing that they already like, or it's so great as a, in the genre that it transcends it, and that even fans that are, gamers that are not fans of the genre should give it a try because it goes beyond that thing. You know, it's the same with movies and books and pretty much everything, and even music. And like, sometimes there is a movie that is, a drama or a superhero movie or an action movie that is so great that even if you don't usually like superhero movies, you might enjoy it. Or if you don't usually like dramas, you would enjoy it. This is that. Celeste is a game that is enjoyable by anyone, and the genre really doesn't matter. So, yeah, as you can tell, I really like it. Let's talk about loot boxes a little bit. There's been some movement there. First of all, in Hawaii, the Representative Lee, I believe, has introduced a bill that would require games with loot boxes to have pretty much the hard line of what I was predicting would probably happen if lawmakers were to legislate on that issue. I say the hard line because it's a little bit of all of the proposals that I thought would be reasonable, because I've always thought that completely forbidding, outlawing loot boxes was not really a feasible approach. It was not something that anyone who knows the industry and understands how things work would seriously consider. It was a lot of angry people saying this, but I think it doesn't work in reality. So anyway, beyond that aspect of it, the hard line would be, first of all, signaling the fact that there are loot boxes, very reasonable. Displaying the percentages, chances of obtaining different types of items. And then the one that I think is a little bit, that makes me wince a little bit, is giving it an age limit. So in this case, in the case of Hawaii, it would be 21. So under 21, you couldn't buy a game that has loot boxes. And I understand the intent. I just think it's, well, we've already talked about it ad nauseum. I'm not going to go back into my reasoning. I think if you want to put an age limit, it's like maybe 16 would be okay. And even then, I'm a little bit hesitant. I've seen so many times the idea that this or that element of culture is going to hurt you. Like, do we really not trust an 18-year-old or 21-year-old with, like, what are they going to do? They're going to spend $15,000 in loot boxes. That's another aspect, actually, that I think is not heavily discussed in that conversation, and which I think is important to look at, is what are the damages being caused by these loot boxes. And I'm not trying to defend loot boxes for the sake of it. I think labels, and we're going to talk about this in a second, labels are fine. Percentages, sure, why not? But over so the thoughts I have on this don't really bear on what I think should be implemented. I don't think banning would be reasonable. I think age limit is okay if you really insist. 21 seems a little high. Like, you can't like at 21 or before 21 in some countries, you can drink, you can smoke, you can drive. But you can't buy a game that has loot boxes in it, like including cosmetic loot boxes. Like, that's a little bit overboard, right? If you can drink and drive and vote, maybe it's okay that you can buy a game, a freaking game with loot boxes. And that leads me to, you know, the comparison with cigarettes and gambling and all of this. Like, loot boxes, I don't think we've seen a lot of damage done by, because when you evoke things like gambling and smoking and all of those, this actually has serious consequences, right? And I think the mechanical, like, oh, there's a thing that explodes and you don't know what's in it and you have items, evokes gambling, but then no one has really been showing that the real danger of gambling is people going bankrupt, right? Because they have this illusion that they're going to get rich and they can't stop themselves from spending all their money in the slot machine or, you know, whatever gambling they do. Or the horses, or like, which, by the way, in most countries you can play those things when you're 21, when you're 18. So again, 21 as an age limit on games. All right. Anyway, so the issue there that I see is the worst I've seen is people, you know, spending maybe, there are two things, people complaining about it and not using it, and people who spend a lot of money in it. And usually it seems they're kind of happy. They're like, well, you know, FIFA Ultimate Team is my game and I love it. And I spend, yeah, maybe 20, 30 bucks a week, 100 bucks a week on it. I've seen those on Reddit, you know, and they say, it's just my game. I want to be spending all that money. And those are very rare cases. I think most people will spend, you know, 20, 50 bucks once, maybe once every 6 months, and they get the thing. Maybe they don't get the thing they wanted to get, and that's it. And again, maybe there's a secret population of people who are incredibly damaged by the plague of loot boxes, and they're spending hundreds and thousands of dollars. And, you know, we've heard a couple of cases of kids getting hold of their parents' credit card and spending hundreds of dollars on mobile games with energy systems, which is a completely different issue, by the way. But I'm not seeing people saying, oh my God, I spent my loan money on the game. It's so, again, I can hear people fuming behind their headsets. I'm not saying we shouldn't do something. I just want to put a little bit of perspective on this, because with the kind of law that is being introduced in Hawaii, it means that a kid can't buy, you know, can't play Hearthstone or can't play Overwatch. And those are the good examples of that category. But even, you know, I've played Destiny 2 a lot. I've played Shadow of War a lot. They have loot boxes. The idea that a kid, someone under 21 cannot buy Destiny 2 is ridiculous. It is ridiculous. I'm sorry. That game is not alcohol. It's not, you know, it doesn't incur the dangers of gambling. So That I've seen, that I've shown. Show me that it does, and then maybe we can talk. But before we start legislating on this, I think we should at least ask those questions. Anyway, so that's my thought on it. I'm sure many people are going to disagree. I think my view on it is somewhat reasonable. And actually, I think someone that is not being very helpful is the ESRB that has introducing a label, which I'm saying would be great. So I do think there are things we should do. But the ESRB is introducing a label that would signal in-game purchases of any kind. And that, I think, is wholly unhelpful. If you are going to include a label, I think it is a good thing, and I would actually think it's necessary at this point. Then you need a label not for in-game purchases. You need a label for loot boxes, and maybe a variation for cosmetic-only loot boxes and gameplay-affecting loot boxes, but not just in-game purchases, because that includes DLC, expansion packs, characters or items you can buy outright. So it doesn't tell you anything. Every single game today has, or let's say 80% of those games have some kind of in-game purchase. So this is not helpful at all. And I think it's a waste of time and energy. At the bare minimum, we would need a surprise box label, basically a loot box label. If you want to do that, then that's what you need. So, I mean, I guess it's better than nothing, but it's like out of 10 for the appropriateness, I think it's like one. It's pointless. So there's that aspect. They're saying it's just the beginning, and they have a lot of discussions in the industry and all of this. But I think hopefully this is when they say it's just the beginning, they're going to have variations of that label, and loot boxes will be one of those. But however, you know, there's an interesting trend that's coming up. We've seen articles in Kotaku and US Gamer talking about different games. One being the next Battlefield apparently is coming out. Well, it's coming out this year, and it's going to be a World War II themed game. So there are a number of developers that they talked to, and people have reacted to the controversy, and developers do not want to be the next Battlefield 2. They are being very cautious about everything, and they are apparently implementing loot boxes, sure, but cosmetic only, which some of those games already had cosmetics, so maybe they were thinking about changing up the models, but they are letting go of pay-to-win ideas for games. And it's not just one, you know, developer. There are a few of them that have been echoing this sentiment. Which leads me to another thought. You know, I've been advocating against anger quite a bit, especially in this debate, and I think it's unhelpful to be so angry about all of this, and it actually fuels unreasonable conversations. There's a small part of me, if I'm being very honest, and I hate being honest, but I guess I have to, a small part of me which wonders, maybe if people hadn't been that unreasonably angry, the consequences wouldn't have been that the industry took that much of a notice. I want to believe that the conversation could have happened without the anger, but there's always going to be that little part of me that wonders, well, if people had been saying, hey guys, this isn't cool, you maybe shouldn't do it, then maybe the developers and publishers would not have taken notice and would not have been now rethinking their strategy. I think it would have been possible, but I'm just trying to be honest here and say there's a possibility it wouldn't have. So yeah, that is the discussion about loot boxes. We'll see how it continues to evolve. I think we're getting somewhere now where things are starting to make sense. Developers are finding the balance, which I think they found with DLC. I've mentioned this a few times. DLC was kind of the outrageous thing a few years ago, and now we have a satisfying win-win system for DLC as well. I think we're getting there with loot boxes too. I really think that if you only have cosmetic items, for example, it's unreasonable to complain that much about it, especially given the context of, you know, how much games cost to develop all of this. I think there might be ways of having items that are not only cosmetic, if it's within certain limits, like only in single player, that's more acceptable. And if you can purchase that item outright as well as getting it in loot boxes that you get by playing the game, for example, or maybe you can also buy loot boxes and buy the thing outright. There are ways of making it not Battlefront 2, basically. So we'll see in the next year or so. I think we'll have this settled. And finally, PlayStation Plus is not going to be available on... PlayStation Plus is... Oh, actually, I was going to say something silly. It was on PS3 and Vita, but it didn't include the online gaming functionality. That is, you need to be a PlayStation Plus member on PS4 if you want to have access to online. But on PS3 and Vita, it was available for free, the online access. However, what was not available was the games that were given for free every month. And in a sign that the PS3 and Vita are... definitely going away into the sunset, PlayStation Plus is not going to include games for those platforms anymore in 2019, in about a year. The PlayStation 4 games are still going to be included, of course, but we won't have PS3 and Vita games after that date. So I don't think it's too much of a miss there. Those platforms are very well eclipsed by the PlayStation 4. And by the way, this month, PlayStation Plus gets you Bloodborne and Ratchet and Clank. So if you're a PlayStation Plus subscriber, don't forget to go get them, because those are two really highly regarded games that you should have in your library. And I think that is going to be it for this episode. Sonic the Hedgehog film in November 2019. I don't even want to think about that. So I'm not gonna. There you go. My last word is going to be, again, check out Celeste. Just go check it out. Go at a friend's house or at the very least, put it on your wish list and get it when it will be discounted in a few months, which it undoubtedly will be. You won't regret it. So, Celeste, it's an awesome game. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Patrick Beja. My Twitter handle is not Patrick. I'm also not Patrick on Facebook. And you can find this show at FrenchSpin.com. Hopefully, we will be back for the next episode with our regular schedule, as I said, where I won't be alone talking to you about just the news. And that will be cool. I hope my little one will allow me a little bit more time. Maybe I'm deluding myself. We'll see. But I will be here and I will talk to you. Have fun. Bye.